Ryan ground his teeth as he and the rest, without Christy, were pushed down the hall toward the elevators. The wives and children waiting in the hallway kicked and slapped them as they passed. It was all part of the evening's entertainment.
Get back in the elevator like before! Go on!
With the Sekhmen's guns pressed hard into their flesh, Ryan and his friends knelt once more.
Lobby! Lobby!
We all knew this could happen, Ryan. We all knew the risk.
Yes, we did. Be assured of that.
You're not to blame, Ryan.
Ryan could think of nothing to say to Jack. No way to make things right. Words can only do so much, and they were cheap. Young Jack was headed for the Mutie Zoo, where death came slowly, sometimes over the course of decades, and only after unspeakable suffering and degradation. He had every right to be angry. With any luck, he wouldn't be there long. When they reached the lobby, two of the Sekhmen separated Jack from the others. The white-haired teen stepped out of the elevator with his armed escort. Lester lit a torch on the wall of the elevator and leaned over the tube again.
Hail! Hail!
One Eye, your friend seemed awfully quiet. Guess you must have told him what goes on in the zoo. Actually, it's a lot worse than when you saw it last. Baron's got the whole place full now. He's collected some of the damnedest looking muties you ever seen. Kinda hard for any of them to get sleep, I imagine. What with all the screaming, screwing, carrying on.
The deeper they went, the darker it got. The torch in the elevator barely cut the gloom.
By the three Kennedys, what is that hellish commotion?
Tell him, Lester.
Shut up!
Tell him.
Fuck you!
It's the wheel.
I said shut the hell up! Somebody close that fucking door!
Lester and the Sekhmen pushed Ryan and company out into the dim corridor. Its dripping concrete walls were unpainted. It was bathed in flickering half-light from the torches stuck in stanchions along the walls. Water in the corridor was ankle-deep in places, and it reeked of decay and mildew.
Dark night. It's colder than a dead sticky's butt down here.
That's why they call it the cooler.
As they were quick-marched along the corridor, they could see steel doors open on both sides, but the light was too poor to make out anything inside the rooms. They followed the corridor around a dogleg to the right and came upon four rooms in a row with closed doors and no doorknobs. Wired to screws bored into the steel at eye level were bunches of sorry-looking plastic flowers, white lilies.
What's in there? Looks like a tomb.
Good guess. Baron Willie Elijah locked his first wife down here years ago. Left her to starve to death. Probably did the same to his three daughters when they got too long in the tooth for him.
All right, hold it there.
Lester stepped around the others and over to a door locked with two big bolts.
Move it.
In the 10x10 room were the cooler's prison cells. The two iron barred cages had been constructed on site. Each stood about 4 feet high, and one was stacked on top of the other. 3 inches of water covered the barred floor of the bottom cage. Even in the weak torchlight, they could see the bloated corpse face down in the far corner. Lester opened the door to the top cage and started shoving his prisoners in. Once inside, they had to crawl or crab walk forward as there wasn't enough room to stand. Doc fumbled in his frock coat for a hanky to cover his nose.
Faith, it stinks to high heavens in here.
That's because your toilet is underneath you. Be glad you don't have to sit in it.
Lester saved Ryan for last. He actually let him get his head in the top cage before jerking him back out.
No, I better not put you up there. Might overcrowd the other prisoners. Might cause them unnecessary distress. Can't have that.
The Sekhmen shut the top cage and opened the bottom one. At gunpoint, he forced Ryan to crawl inside on his hands and knees. There was no way to stay out of the vile water or avoid the rank, soft stalactites hung from the bars of the cage floor above his head. Ryan hunkered down, making himself as small as he possibly could.
Like it, Cawdor.
Look on the bright side, Lester. Maybe the Stickies will overrun Willieville tonight. Maybe you won't live long enough to do your time on the wheel.
Lester exited the room, plunging them into total darkness.
Ryan, what's the wheel, anyway?
It's what the Baron calls his elevator motor.
Is it as bad as this?
It's worse.
Good.
Jack had two alternatives in mind as he walked out the front of the Freedom City Motor Hotel and Casino. To escape or die trying. Daylight was completely gone. The color had all but drained out of the world. Jack's ruby-red eyes worked better at night than most other people's. If he could put some distance between himself and the Sekhmen, he knew he could evade them and reach the wall. True, he was unarmed and without food or water, facing an army of stickies in the dark, but any death he could think of was better than a life sentence in the Baron's zoo. He couldn't count on Ryan for a rescue. The one-eyed man had his own troubles. The Sekhmen didn't make it easy for him. Figuring that their captive would try to make a break for it, they stopped long enough to bind his wrists together with a thong. They lit their hand torches from a stanchion, then led him across the fractured parking lot toward the entrance to the Independence Park amusement zone. As Jack glanced back, he saw the Baron's men running out of the hotel with torches in their hands. On orders of their feudal lord, they were setting alight every lamppost that they passed. If the stickies broke through the berm and entered the grounds tonight, Elijah wanted his defenders to be able to see them. The amusement zone's entrance was framed by a tall arch made of bands of wrought iron. Human-sized statuettes capered across it. Because Jack had never seen a cartoon, he didn't recognize them as fictional characters. With their distorted heads and bodies, spindly legs, and oversized hands, he thought Mumbly Mouse, Wazoo Wildcat, and Pee-wee Poodle were muties. He thought the arch had been specially constructed to mark the way to the Baron's zoo. At that moment, Jack felt more kinship to the cartoon characters than to his trusted companions of so many years. Since the jump dream, his attitude towards his friends had changed. The sticky nightmare had done something to him that he couldn't explain to the others. New and powerful ideas swirled through his head in a torrent. After all, he had sat at the feet of Lord Ka and listened to his teachings, not with ears, because he had none in the dream, but with the core of his mind. He was an albino, not a mutie, but the seed had been planted that told him who his true enemies were. The norms. He was one, but he was not. According to Ka, norms had only one purpose in the great scheme of things, and that was to bring Deathlands and its people into being. Having done that, the norms were worse than useless. They were an obstacle to further progress because they refused to relinquish the power they had held for so long. Throughout their history, the norms had proved they had no lasting allegiance to their own kind, and yet they continually fooled themselves into believing such bonds existed. Ryan Carter was no exception. Hardened fighter though he was, he still thought that Baron Elijah would see the light and act according to reason, in the best interests of all. Ryan believed that Willieville and everything it stood for was worth not only his blood, but the blood of his comrades. How long he would hold this opinion, it was impossible to say. In the jump dream, Ka had shown Jack that norms couldn't be trusted to see past their own short-term self-interest. Their federations and alliances were doomed to split apart. They would die as they had been born, as individuals, in isolation. And in isolation, they would become extinct. Ka had explained that at the root of much of the endless dissension and bloodshed among the norms were arguments over which of their many races had come first, and which, therefore, were the most favored children of their creator. Ka taught that the new people had no such internal divisions. Muties of every stripe, no matter when they were born, shared a common date of origin. January 20th, 2001. Nuke Day. They suffered a common oppression. They had a common destiny, which was to unite and remake, to unite and rule Deathlands forever. There was glory here, on a scale that Jack had never imagined. And in that glory was a place for him. As they penetrated the amusement zone, the Sekhmen set fire to the torches atop the lampposts. Ahead of them, the wide, curving asphalt lane was dark. The place practically cried out for an ambush. Jack could sense the guards' growing nervousness. Even if they didn't completely believe the stickies were drawing near, the idea made them jumpy all the same. On either side of the path loomed the strange mechanical-looking structures of the fun rides. Cylinders of wire mesh, hoops of steel I-beams, cages attached to long metal arms. All were frozen, dead. At the entrances to each ride were low chain-link fences and steel turnstiles for crowd and ticket control, which hadn't been a concern for more than a century. Then they approached a two-story building with more of the Muti-like figures decorating its side and roof. For a moment, Jack was sure that he'd blown it, that he'd waited too long to make his break. But the building turned out to be just another deserted ride, the Ghost Castle Spook Train. Like the other amusement rides, it was no longer powered by fossil fuel or electricity. It was powered by live beings. Muti slaves dragged the miniature railroad cars through the darkened spook house. Muties in chains leapt out of hiding places in the blackness to try to scare the Norm passengers. Jack decided he was as close to the rear of the park and freedom as he was going to get. He had to act now or never. He pointed at the shadows beside the building.
Stickies!
Where?
The white-haired teen snapped a spin kick into the closest set man's face.
You bastard!
A hand grabbed his neck from behind, fingers sinking into his flesh. Jack twisted away, slamming his doubled fists into the man's side. As he started to run, he saw the path he'd chosen was blocked by a huge guard with arms outstretched.
Don't let him get away!
The sick men dropped their torches and closed in on him.
Hey, Snowhair, where do you think you're going?
Jack feinted right, then spun left, shooting a snap kick hard into the center of the speaker's throat. The sick man dropped to his knees, clawing at his neck. Before Jack could make his dash, the other sick men jumped him, and by the sheer weight of their bodies, drove him to his back on the ground.
You bastard, run!
Jack saw stars as he was hit repeatedly, then kicked and stomped up and down the length of his torso. As consciousness began to slip away, Jack prayed that the bastards would lose control and beat him to death. But they were pros. They knew just when to stop. Grabbing him by the armpits, they hauled his battered and bloody body to the gates of the Muti Zoo. Through swollen eyes, Jack saw a stout man with greasy gray hair and knee-high rubber boots come out of a building just past the gates. The Baron's Zoo Master.
Got a fresh one for you, Knockerman!
The Zoo Master walked up, leaned down, and lifted Jack's head by the hair.
Pure albino variant, maybe. Kinda hard to tell the way you messed him up. Tried to get away!
He'll live, don't worry. He's a tough little bugger. Where do you want him?
I don't want him. Baron's got too damn many packed in here as it is. Pretty soon they're gonna start dying from the scour sickness. They're already killing each other every chance they get. I keep telling them it's a mistake to overcrowd his zoo. The Baron don't care. He likes variety. Always more muties, he says. This way.
They dragged Jack into the building. The concrete corridor was dark and dank, and it reeked of the unwashed creatures imprisoned behind its floor-to-ceiling cages.
They seem wilder than usual tonight. Maybe they smell this one black.
Yeah, something's got into them all right. Throw them in here!
Jack was hurled inside. He landed face down on the foul, matted straw. As Jack pushed himself up onto his elbows, his facial wounds reopened. He tasted fresh blood inside his mouth. Rising to his knees, he scanned his surroundings. He couldn't see much now that the Sekman's torches were gone, even with his mutated eyes. But he could see enough to know that he wasn't alone in the cage. At the back of the enclosure, where it was darker than dark, a huge pair of yellow cat eyes glittered at him. Lester, Highlander, and Gil lay belly down in a shallow pit they had scraped in the dirt. Gil glanced over his shoulder.
Shit! Listen to them rat-blasted buggers!
Chilling each other like always.
No, it's different. I don't know how, but it is. It's like they know something's about to happen.
Maybe it's all the lats out here. Some mutants get strange about fire. Makes them go animal.
Every torch in Willyville was lit. The ruined highway rest stop glowed orange and golden from thousands upon thousands of points of firelight. Lester and his men were stationed at the edge of the open ground between the zoo and the berm wall. On the other side of the berm were the slave quarters. Their mission was to observe, then pull back and report if the stickies broke through. As precarious as their position was, Lester found it hard to keep his attention focused on the top of the berm. Ryan Cotter's words kept running through his head. They raised questions he didn't want to face, but couldn't stop thinking about. How many Norms actually survived a turn at the wheel? especially Sekhmen. Offhand, he couldn't remember any. After all, unless there was an accident, it wasn't the wheel that killed you. It was your fellow workers. The muties slaving in the sub-basement were condemned to death, sentenced by the Baron to labor until they dropped in their chains. They had nothing to lose by killing a Sekhmen. They looked at the opportunity as a kind of bonus. Even though the muties were manacled to their posts as they pushed the wheel around, Lester knew they had their own ways of doing the deed, none of them pleasant. If he wanted to live through the Baron's punishment, he had to bribe the overseers into keeping the muti slaves off his back. His good buddies, Gil and Highlander, hadn't once mentioned his impending ordeal. Maybe they figured they already had enough to worry about tonight. Maybe they didn't want to have to lend him any jack, in case he came up short with the overseers. In either case, Lester was too bone-tired to take offense. None of it probably mattered, anyway. If there really were 5,000 stickies coming, the odds of 100 or so Sekhmen holding them off until dawn were slim. There was just too much vill to defend. Realizing this, the Baron had ordered explosive charges planted along the most likely attack routes. The battle plan was to retreat, then detonate the explosives under the stickies, retreat and detonate, all the way back to the hotel, and in the process, reduce the enemy's numbers as much as possible. Once the Sekhmen had pulled back to the hotel, they'd defend it from the ground up, room by room. If the sticky force turned out to be smaller than what Ryan Carter had described, and this was what every Sekhmen in Willyville was fervently praying for, the initial retreat of the Baron's defenders would mask a massing of their forces. It would let groups of stickies break through the berm barrier in specific places, funneling them into prearranged kill zones. Lester, Highlander, and Gil had drawn the unenviable task of leading the stickies to slaughter. In the grand scheme of things, they were live bait. Christy was stripped naked, stretched out on her belly across the Baron's dining table. Sekhmen held her wrists and ankles and pinned her hip bones against the edge of the tabletop. She couldn't see what was going on behind her, but she could feel it. Fingers lightly brushed the red shock of her pubic hair. Then, cold glass pressed against her upturned buttocks. The Baron tipped a candle closer. Molten wax dripped and splattered onto the sensitive skin at the base of Christy's spine, making her flinch and jerk against the grip of the Sekhmen.
Gotta check her for pustules right off. Can't be putting the new ones in the zoo and doing it later. Never know what kind of sickness these muties might be carrying. Before you know it, whatever they've got, it spreads through the rest of them like wildfire. I learned that the hard way years ago. This little scaly bitch I bought off a trader from the Darks came in infected with some kind of rad mutated STD. It nearly wiped out my zoo. Killed half my adult specimens before I got control of things. No. You can't be too careful with the pustules. I always check the new females for rad cancer, too. They can look okay on the outside, but then they ooze and drip like a dead dog's belly once you try to breed them.
Christy craned her head around as far as she was able. She could see the white frizz of hair on top of Elijah's head. He was writing with a pencil stub in a thick, cloth-bound book. Christy thought he could have been making some kind of measurements of her private parts, taking notes on her general physical appearance. But her instincts told her it was sheer nonsense and bluster, meant to impress ignorant Sekhmen with his command of pre-apocalyptic scientific procedure.
Turn her over and hold her head real still.
When the Sekhmen twisted her onto her back, Christy saw that Elijah had picked up a short, sharp knife. From the look on his face, she thought he was going to gut-slit her for sure. The situation seemed so desperate that she was on the verge of summoning her Gaia power, something she was very reluctant to do except as a last resort. She had no doubt that her unique connection to the feminine forces of the Earth could give her enough strength to break free of the guards who held her spread-eagled. But then what? There were other armed Sekhmen in the room. Even with Gaia's help, it would take several strokes of luck for her to kill them all. And if she managed it, using the power left her weak and trembly, and she still had nowhere to go. Christy forced herself to relax. The time wasn't right.
I want to take a sample of hair.
At least there were only a handful of Sekhmen to see the show. The Baron had cleared the room of his wives and assorted toadies. Like most malevolent despots, Willy Elijah found he enjoyed depriving his subjects of pleasure more than he liked granting it to them. The Baron rounded the side of the table, then grabbed a thick lock of her prehensile red hair. Stretching it out, with a quick slash of the blade, he lopped it off near the root. Christie's sinuous mass of her hair retracted at the insult, coiling tightly against her skull. Christie felt as if she had lost a finger or a toe, and the pain rushed across her scalp in burning waves. Elijah dropped the severed strand onto a plate and watched it writhe. It didn't bleed from the cut end. Other than the violent motion, it appeared to be normal hair. The thrashing continued for a few seconds, then it slowed, and the hair gradually became still.
Unusual.
The Baron reached across her breasts for his notebook, which lay open on the table. Pulling the ledger onto her belly, he hastily scribbled something with his pencil stub.
Which muti are you going to mate her with first?
Too soon to decide. I'll isolate her for a few months. Have Nackerman time her periods. When I figure out when she's due to be fertile, I'll chain her down on her back and let one of my best muti studs have a go at her for a few days.
Lucky red-ass bastard.
The prospect of being mated against her will momentarily plunged Christie back into the primal terror of her jump dream. It wasn't just the threat of sexual violence and victimization that scared her. It was the idea of being forced to bear young when there was no way of telling what kind of baby would emerge at the end of term. Once again, Christie experienced the helplessness of the nightmare. Once again, her enormously swollen belly contained a staggering weight and dozens of tiny legs kicking, hands scratching, needle teeth piercing, ripping. With an effort of will, she fought off the sensations. The fear of giving birth to monsters was something she shared with practically all of Deathland's sentient females. What with lingering radiation hotspots, polluted aquifers, and chem-saturated rain, post-Armageddon genetics was an ongoing game of Russian roulette. Everyone realized that most of the fresh mutations induced by the environment were lethal, and if not that, then debilitating or disfiguring in some way. Though outwardly she didn't seem to have been impacted negatively by the changes in her mother's genetic structure, Christie couldn't know whether the genes she now carried had been damaged in the course of her life, and if so, all her future offspring. Deep down, she understood that it was possible her DNA had already been compromised so badly that the Gaia line would end with her. The Baron smiled at her, almost paternally.
I'm done for now. Let her put her clothes back on.
Under the prying gaze of all those male eyes, Christie dressed herself with all the dignity she could muster. She had won a pair of small victories. She had gotten through the exam alive, and she had kept her Gaia power a secret.
Is there anything else I should know about you? Any other interesting muti peculiarities?
She looked at Elijah for a moment, as if trying to decide whether she should speak at all.
I do have a power that can't be seen.
And that is?
I'm a Dumi.
Christie hoped he couldn't tell she was seriously exaggerating. She did have some ability to visualize the future, and in particular impending danger, but her gift was very limited and imprecise.
Really? What do you see in store for me?
Christie closed her eyes.
A bright future for you and yours. A long, healthy life. I see many girl great-great-grandbabies. Much power. You will gain a broader reach throughout the East. Before you draw your last breath, fear of your name will have spread across all of Deathlands.
So you don't see any stickies in my future? Don't you believe what your friend One Eye says about a conquering army coming this way?
Oh, I believe, because I saw the stickies on the toll road with my own eyes.
You saw this muti leader, too?
Yes, I did. He was big, with brown and white patches on his skin.
Baron, could it be him coming back after all this while? Could it be? Sit.
Elijah silenced the man with a wave of his hand. Christie looked the Baron in the eye.
For some reason, the stickies don't seem to influence any part of your future. Either they don't attack, or you repel them when they do. It isn't clear to me.
I like this doomy bitch.
Christie smiled fetchingly at him, bartering now for any small advantage she could get. Though her situation looked fairly hopeless, there were any number of ways that things could still work out for her and her friends.
How long you been running with Carter?
Not long. A few months.
More lies, but the Baron's gaze turned shrewd.
You must be screwing him, then. Funny that One Eye should take up with a muti slut like you. Or that you'd take up with him after what he'd done.
Although maybe he didn't tell you.
Tell me what?
That he hired out to me as a mercy during the Muti War. He was part of a special chill crew I sent into rebel-held territory. A bunch of escaped Muti slaves had built up this scratch-ass little ville in the middle of nowhere and named it Coop after one of their dead. They were nothing but a bunch of dirt farmers armed with blasters they stole from me. My orders were to make an example of them, to chill the ones that put up a fight and drag the others back here where I could work them to death good and proper. Your pal Carter and the other mercies and sick men surrounded Coopville. The muties saw them coming, though, and barricaded themselves in their huts. My men blasted the place up a little to show that they meant business. After the rebels knew they were licked, they threw out their weapons. They wanted to surrender and go home in chains, but One Eye wouldn't hear of it. He went a little crazy. He was a cold heart bastard back then. He set fire to the place and burned them up in their huts. Women and Muti brats, too. My crew didn't bring back a single prisoner from Coopville. Word about the massacre spread real quick through the rebel territory. Lots of them gave up without a fight after that. Cawdor did me a big favor by going wild. Too bad he lost his taste for mass chilling. He lit out on me not long after.
No, he never said anything about that to me.
Christy figured it was what the Baron wanted to hear. That it was close to the truth was just a coincidence. Ryan had told her and the others that he and the Baron had had a disagreement over prisoner policy. He hadn't given them any of the details. Christy had no way of knowing whether the Baron had made up the massacre story. Elijah could be trying to turn her against Ryan in order to make her a more pliant zoo specimen, or to get information from her about him and about whoever supposedly was backing him.
Take her down to the zoo. Tell Nackerman I want her kept isolated. Have him put females in the cages either side of her. I don't want any males getting at her. Until I say so.
The sick men grabbed her arms and started dragging her off. Determined to make a last attempt to convince Elijah whose side she was on, she stomped the toes of the nearest guard with the stacked heel of her cowboy boot. She pulled free and twisted back to face the Baron.
If it comes down to a fight tonight between you and the Stickies, my skin is going to be on the line just like everybody else's. I can handle a blaster pretty good. I'd like the chance to die with one in my hand. If the Stickies come, you're going to need every blaster you can get.
But I don't need a Muti slut with a blaster aimed at the back of my head. Get her out of here.
The creature crouched so low in the straw that even as Jack rose to his feet, he couldn't make out the shape of its body. He had no way of telling what kind of mutated being he was sharing the cell with. No clue whether it was friend or foe. The teenager retreated as far as he could go, pressing his back against the bars at the front of the cage.
Hey, you! Over there! Yellow eyes!
At the sound of Jack's voice, the creature started to advance. It moved toward him very slowly, with utmost caution and stealth. And as it closed the distance, Jack noticed that the position of its eyes had dropped nearer to the ground. It was coiling, preparing to spring on him. Jack wiped his battered mouth with the back of his hand, wondering if the smell of his blood was attracting it. There was nothing he could do about that. He couldn't stop the flow. The eyes speared into him, shifting as the creature moved to his left. It was trying to back him into a corner. Jack knew better than to let that happen. He countered by shifting to the left as well. The creature froze. Jack's chest rattled from the roar. He knew those enormous cat eyes didn't augur well. In the world of adaptation, they indicated hunter, carnivore, killer by instinct. Jack accepted his fate with a broad, defiant grin. He saw it as a blessing, not a curse. It was his chance to escape the Baron's animal farm with his head held high. A chance to go out quick and go out fighting. He kicked the straw at the yellow eyes.
Come on, let's go!
Jack dodged as soft fur brushed his shoulder, and with it came raging body heat and the scent of musk and urine. Without thinking, Jack whirled and leapt onto the creature's back. The cat's body was over 6 feet long, not counting the tail. The great knobs of bone along its spine gouged Jack's chest and crotch. His hands found and gripped the pointed horns curving out from the sides of its neck, a permanent defense against throat attacks by larger predators. Jack locked his legs around the beast's narrow waist and held on for dear life. Twisting in fury, the Mute mountain lion tried to dislodge the boy by crashing its sides against the bars. Jack wouldn't be scraped off. The cat twisted its head around as far as the horns would permit and tried to snap a bite out of him. Jack choked on its fetid breath and kept out of range. He couldn't control the animal's head. It was too strong. The cat lunged forward, bending almost double as it ducked its head under its chest. It struck upward along its sides with its front claws, missing him by inches. When this failed, it threw itself on the straw and tried to roll him off. Though the full weight of the beast crashed down on top of him, Jack wouldn't let go of the horns. The muty cat rolled back onto its belly. Jack punched it in the ribcage with everything he had. The jolt of the impact registering all the way to his shoulder joint. It was like hitting a side of beef. The cat's massive ribs absorbed the rain of blows, which had no effect, other than to tire Jack out. There was no way to get at the creature's vitals, its soft underbelly, without exposing himself to the tearing fangs and claws. His only hope was to wear out the great beast. Leaping to its feet, the cat crashed around the cell again, scraping its rider against the walls, trying to grind him down if it couldn't knock him off. Both combatants had the same idea, to exhaust the opponent and then take advantage. The contest of wills dragged on and on. Neither fighter would yield. Though both gradually weakened, neither gained the upper hand. Finally, the muty cat began to slow down, which was lucky for Jack, because his arms were exhausted. Still, the creature wouldn't quit. It moved in tighter and tighter circles until it collapsed to its stomach on the straw. The beast's huge tongue rolled out of its mouth. Against Jack's chest, the cat's fur was warm and soft. Jack blinked as he realized the soothing rumble vibrating through every cell of his body was the huge cat purring. It was strangely relaxing, hypnotic. After a few minutes, the lion put its chin on its front paws. Jack let go of a horn and reached out to touch its ear. It was pointed, fat, and furry. The teenager suddenly found it difficult to keep his eyes open. His every muscle felt drained and limp. He knew he had to get up and find a way to kill the cat before it recovered, but he needed to rest for just a minute. Soon, they were both snoozing in the dark, oblivious to the continuing bedlam around them.
Stuff and damn taradiddle. This is by far the vilest jail in which I've ever passed a night. Fouler by far than the infamous torture dungeon of the late and unlamented Baron Jordan Teague of Moxonville. More loathsome than the human terrarium of Baron Sean Sharp. And, having had the benefit of an abundance of personal experience with the inventors and operators of similar establishments between here and proverbial Pisstown, USA, I can tell you this. Only a pox-riddled brain could have devised such a hellhole. Only a soulless beast could confine a fellow being to such a filthy pit.
From what I've seen, you've described Baron Willie Elijah to a T, Doc. Not only demented by his own self-indulgent addictions, but savagely cruel for fun.
I knew what a psycho he used to be in the old days, but I still didn't think we'd end up here.
It is water over the dam, my dear Ryan. Water over the dam. There's no going back now. Our fates are well and truly cast. And though grim they are, it behooves us to try to make the best of them.
John, how long has it been?
It was so dark in the cooler that the radium dial of JB's wrist chron gave off an eerie green glow, partially illuminating his face.
We've been down here for close to 5 hours. I'll make daylight another 4 hours off.
So what happened to the army of stickies?
If they had shown up, we'd have known about it. Even down here, we should have been able to hear the segment's blaster fire. You can bet they aren't going to hold anything back.
But where the blazes are they? Why haven't they attacked? We all know they couldn't have been more than 3 hours behind us on the toll road. They should have been here by now if they're coming.
Oh, dark night, Mildred. Don't say that.
Why not? It's a possibility we've got to face at some point. The stickies might just be headed someplace else. Maybe our guy with the brown and white patches has other plans we don't know about. Hey, for all we know, they all turned around and headed south after we left them. It's possible we could have screwed up.
Ryan shifted in his narrow, waterlogged lower cell, moving from agonizing pain to somewhat lesser discomfort. His back, neck, and legs were cramping from so many hours of a permanently hunched-over position and near-constant shivering. The stench of death and excrement remained as thick as fog in the airless, sealed room, but it now only occasionally made him dry heave. His senses of smell and taste had been overloaded and largely negated by prolonged, concentrated exposure to the stink.
We assumed Elijah would free us to help him fight Stickies. If there's no battle, he could just leave us here to die.
If the Stickies get the upper hand early on, the Baron might lose the contest before he lets us out to fight. Nobody would ever look for us in here.
My friends, you are not making the best of what is an admittedly bad situation. You are, in fact, further confounding matters by dwelling on the morbid and defeatist.
Doc's right. If we let ourselves think we're done for, we are. I know Elijah, and he's not going to leave us to die here in the dark. He's going to want to watch. More than that, he's the kind of cheap bastard that likes to milk some benefit out of a chilling as a spectacle for his followers, or a few days of slave labor he didn't have to pay for. At least the segment didn't manacle us. They figured we'd be so weak after an overnight session in here that we couldn't put up a fight. We still got our hands and feet free. Save your strength as best you can.
Ryan, what are you doing down there?
Ryan had dropped to his hands and knees and was crawling toward the corner of his cell.
I'm checking out our dead friend. Maybe they left something on him we can use.
Ryan fumbled in the darkness in front of him until he touched the back of the corpse. Then he ran his hands over the ice-cold, distended body.
How long's he been dead?
Who knows? All I can say is, his hair sloughs off in big clumps whenever I touch it.
Ryan braced his foot against the cell wall and, grabbing the corpse's shoulder, slowly tried to turn it onto its side toward him.
Fire blast. Can't turn the damn thing over. Its underside is stuck to the bars and it's swelled up. If I pull any harder, it's going to split open. It's got ankle shackles. They're made of some kind of metal, hinged in the back. No chain between them. The segment must have forgotten them. These have possibilities. Oh, shit. I can't slide them off. Their ankles are too swollen.
Are his shackles welded shut?
No, they've got a lock. I can feel the hole for the key.
If I was down there with you, I could pick the locks easy. I got a piece of wire in my pocket that the sec men missed.
Can you lift the corpse's legs? If you can raise the feet up close to the ceiling, JB can reach through the bars and work.
Ryan got a grip on one of the slimy, rotting legs and bent it at the knee, lifting the ankle up as high as he could.
Sweet. The smell.
I think his guts just broke loose.
JB reached down through the bars and, finding the dead man's foot, set to picking the crude lock that held the shackle shut.
Next!
Ryan got the other foot up to the armorer, who removed that shackle too. The one-eyed warrior gently laid the leg back down to avoid getting even more of the foulness splashed anywhere on him. JB tested the tab end of a shackle against the bars of the cage. The hinged bands were 2.5 inches wide and 1/8 of an inch thick.
Feels like they're made of soft iron. They should take an edge okay, but they won't hold one for long.
Don't need it for long.
That's right. Just a couple of well-timed slashes.
They started taking turns scraping the iron against the concrete walls. It was slow work. Every so often, the results would be passed over to JB, who checked the angle they were putting on the edges. Nobody mentioned the pathetic nature of this effort. Whether the makeshift weapons would ultimately help to advance their cause or not, at least they were doing something. Flanked by a small group of Stickies, Lord Ka and Rogero had crawled to a hilltop vantage point within a half mile of the Willyville defensive berm. Nestled in the back hollow of the valley below, Baron Elijah's township twinkled in outline. Yellow points of light defined its perimeter, its height, its breadth. There were so many torches burning, it looked as if the whole ville had been set on fire. Lord Ka leaned close to Rogero, almost touching, so his paladin could hear him.
The gnomes are expecting us to pay them a visit tonight. Baron Elijah only lights his vill like that when he suspects an attack. Word of our victory in the south must have spread up the toll road ahead of us. It's a safe guess that every one of Elijah's sectmen is standing watch at the barricades with blaster in hand. Won't they all be disappointed when dawn comes and we still haven't shown ourselves?
As Rogero watched the distant flames, its fingers clawed furrows in the dirt. Ka understood his paladin's need and the needs of the other members of the wrecked party. The sight of fires in the valley excited them and kindled an urge to wreak mindless havoc. Ka knew that if he hadn't been there to help them contain their enthusiasm, the Sticky's primal bloodlust would have taken over. Rogero and the others would have rushed down into the light and hurled themselves upon the Ville's walls, dying pointlessly there under the Baron's concentrated gunfire, dying in an attempt to satisfy what could never be satisfied, their species' thirst for violence and slaughter. The piebald lord reached up and carefully peeled back the lids of his third eye. All the Stickies on the hilltop jerked as one, called to attention by some invisible puppet master. They saw not through their own eyes, but through the dead white glistening orb in their leader's forehead. With infinite patience, in a series of carefully constructed mental images, Ka showed them the tactical situation. He showed them groups of their fellow Stickies already in position, concealed at various points around Willyville's perimeter. He explained that no matter what the Baron did, they were in complete control of the battlefield. There was no escape from their wrath, no survival for the Norms inside the Ville. This night, the Baron would stew in his own fatty juices, pacing the halls of his palace like a prisoner, waiting for an assault that wouldn't come. His Sekhmen would go without sleep. By daybreak, they would have lost confidence that a real enemy even existed. By noon of the following day, after 18 hours of full combat alert and no hint of a foe, they would be mentally and physically drained, and even easier to defeat. Ka expected the Baron to send morning patrols outside the berm, patrols that, when the time came, would be quickly and quietly taken care of. They would simply vanish. The Baron never committed his Sekhmen to outside night sweeps. He and his colony of Norms had always counted on the barrier to secure them against the forces of darkness, and relied on the perimeter's stationary gunposts to concentrate and control any would-be attackers. Night had always belonged to the Muties. They were about to expand their sphere of influence. Having made his point, Lord Ka placed a calming hand on top of his paladin's head. Rogero's hairless scalp was clammy with sweat, its eyes as dead and emotionless as polished black stones. Ka pulled the side of the sticky, slubby face close to his mouth.
There will be victims yet tonight.
The Stickies pressed their faces into the dirt, demonstrating their gratitude and subservience. The Lord of the Mutants pinched his third eyelid shut and picked up his treasured M60 machine gun. He had named it Joyeuse, after the fabled enchanted sword of Charlemagne. A scaly witch had decorated the gun for him, painting it with neon spells against harm. Ka and his followers scooted back behind the crest of the hill, then started along the track that led to his main encampment. He was the only member of the wreck party carrying a gun or a stabber. Stickies, as a rule, weren't fond of weapons, pre-dark or otherwise. They preferred to use their sucker hands and needle teeth for killing. As with other hunter species, most of the space in their brains was devoted to fine control of their primary sensory apparatus. All their pink matter went to smell, taste, and sight. There was no room for higher thought. The Stickies' mental shortcomings notwithstanding, Ka had the greatest respect for their physical abilities and their loyalty. They killed for him, bred for him, died for him. What more could any general ask of a foot soldier? Baron Willie Elijah gave up trying to sleep. Scowling, He opened his eyes and took in the glitter-flecked, rough-textured, white-plaster ceiling of the penthouse master bedroom. On his left, on the king-size bed, in a tangled mass of untucked covers, lay Poonie 2 and Toonie 2. The sisters were snoozing in each other's arms. On his right, stretched out on top of the rumpled sheets, was Rooney 2. Poonie 2's legs kept twitching, kicking him in the shin. In the normal course of events, Elijah was the first one asleep and missed the snore chorus of his three wives. The night past had been different, however. Not only hadn't he gotten to sleep first, but he hadn't dozed off at all. He had left orders with his secmen to be roused at the first sign of an attack. Then he had lain wide awake, waiting for the crackle of gunfire. Elijah gazed across the snowy expanse of Rooney 2's bare behind to the sunrise spilling through the curtainless floor-to-ceiling windows of the baronial penthouse. Evidently, there had been no attack.
So much for One-Eye Carter's sticky army. What was that traitor's coward thinking? He has to have known that his pack of lies would be uncovered and his fate sealed by dawn. Maybe he was hoping that the chaos of a full nighttime mobilization would allow him and his friends to escape. Now that's a dumb fuck move.
Feeling the pressure of a full bladder, the Baron climbed over his granddaughter wives and padded naked and barefoot across the bedroom suite. He threw back the sliding glass door to the patio. The day looked promising, not too hot, not too wet. A good day for business. Stepping closer to the edge, he sent a yellow stream arching over the balcony's rail and down 25 stories onto the unprotected heads of his subjects. Willie the Sun King. When Elijah re-entered the room, some of the things he had passed the long night thinking about, things he hadn't bothered to consider for years, resurfaced in his head. He relived the single most formative incident of his childhood. When the Baron was a boy, his father, who had always appeared to be a perfect norm, had gone cannibal after skinning and eating a 3-foot-tall muti bear he'd found, stiff dead, in a clearing. Willie's mother had tried to talk him out of keeping the foul-smelling meat, but the old man had insisted on making a meal of it. The following day, while Willie was away from their camp, his father had attacked his mother, sisters, and brothers. When Willie returned, he found his entire family gutted, skinned, and staked out to dry in the sun. His father was just sitting there with his belly all pooched out and a stupid grin on his face. He was so stuffed with hearts, lungs, and livers, he could hardly move. Which made it a whole lot easier for young Willie to crack his skull open with a sharp bit of rock. He dumped all the bodies down a fissure in the earth. All he kept back were a few locks of his mother's and sister's hair, which he still had, tied up in ribbons, somewhere. Shortly after the patricide, Elijah had begun his career as a cold heart robber along a desolate reach of the 6-lane highway that ran past Freedom City, USA. His modus operandi was simple. He crept up on travelers while they were sleeping and clubbed them to death for their worldly goods. His first real break came when he took a gun and some bullets off one of his victims. After that, he moved up in the world rapidly. He headed a gang of other cold hearts that specialized in trading muti slaves and pushing a cheap and inferior grade of jolt. Eventually, he got hired on by Baron George Frederick Sokolow, the previous lord of Freedom City. Elijah's job was to supply fresh slaves to work the Baron's plowed fields. With the help of the Baron's wife, he had murdered old Sokolow and taken his place in both the feudal and matrimonial arenas. He had done away with his princess wife after she had born and raised him three healthy and ripe Norm daughters. Elijah's longevity at the helm was due to a combination of factors. Certainly his ruthlessness played a large part in his success. He also had an ability to manipulate people and keep them at a disadvantage. He stirred up constant intrigues among Sekhmen and toadies, then conducted bloody purges of those he considered the most dangerous. No one had dared to raise a hand to him in more than 20 years. The Baron had spent a good deal of the night thinking about Zit and wondering what, if anything, the muti had taken with him when he'd run off some years ago. At the time, Elijah had vowed that Zit would be the last muti he'd ever trust. He'd raised up a lot of others from pups. He could always look in their eyes and read their intentions as plain as day. He thought he could read Zit, too, but he couldn't. Maybe it had something to do with the slave's screwed-up genes.
He'd never seen a mutie go through a change the way Zit had. According to the Mercies who'd brought him in, he'd been born with that patchy-colored skin and weepy sore in his forehead. About the time the boy started to show signs of manhood, the sore crusted over, and when the scab dropped off, it had turned into a full-fledged eyeball, albeit as white as an egg, with loose, lashless eyelids. Zit had grown up to be a big bastard, but the way he always walked around, with his head hanging down so meek, none of the Willyville norms were afraid of him. But muties were another story. Zit put the fear of God into his own kind. Once he had his growth, Elijah worked Zit as an overseer, first in the fields, then in the elevator motor. He did such a good job bullying and beating that the Baron let him handle the duties of executioner whenever the job came up. Sometimes Elijah would get a mutie slave who wouldn't be tamed and had to be destroyed. Death sentences were also imposed if a mutie stole something or looked at a norm funny. Elijah had been stunned to learn that his archivist had gone over the wall. It was like a slap in the face to him. He'd been sure that if any damn mutie was ready to lick his baronial ass and beg for more, it was Zit. He blamed book learning for a lot of the trouble, which was why he never let his girls get any education. He didn't want them getting any ideas he hadn't planted himself. Zit had somehow managed to sneak off and teach himself to read better than almost anybody in Willyville. The Baron really had no way of telling whether Zit had got his dangerous notions about freedom from the Apocalypticon, or whether he already had them when he started to work on the collection. The rare books and secret papers had strange powers. After all, they had run the whole pre-dark world. Elijah had always been a hoarder, a pack rat. As a boy, he was always picking up bright, shiny objects he found during the family's food-gathering expeditions. Now that he was rich, he freely indulged his compulsion. He had spent much time and treasure accumulating the trove of material. He had put out the word on the Trader Network that he would pay top jack for anything pre-dark and in good shape. Of course, there were practical reasons for the expenditure, too. The mystery of the Apocalypticon added to his wealth and power because it furthered his legend as a master of the arcane and dark. It didn't matter that the legend was a bald-faced lie. Elijah could read, but haltingly. And he certainly couldn't make heads or tails of the acronym-littered technobabble that much of the documentation was written in.
Where are you going, Papa Daddy?
Rooney, too, squinted over at him, and he picked up his corduroy pants from the floor and started to pull them on.
Come back to bed now. It's too early.
Got important work to do, gal.
Elijah stepped into his shoes and left the bedroom. At the far end of the penthouse suite, with a commanding view of the highway and valley to the north, was his operations room. The sec men and high-level toadies sitting around the long table jumped to their feet when he entered. All their eyes were red-rimmed and dark-circled. The toadies' faces looked even sallower than usual. Elijah took his place at the head of the table.
I take it we had a quiet night, Murch?
Murchison, his longtime sec chief, nodded.
So quiet you might even call it dull, Baron.
Elijah tipped the lid off a bucket of tipple on the floor and used a dipper to ladle himself a breakfast pint.
I don't suppose any of the runners are back yet?
No, sir. Don't expect to see them until midday, if then.
You don't think old Blackheart Hutton and the other barons are going to send any men our way, do you? You think they're more likely to sit back and hope we get eaten alive? Let the rad-blasted stickies do their dirty work for them, then come by after the smoke clears and fight over the pickings.
My thoughts exactly, sir.
You're probably right. They know I'd do the same thing to them if the opportunity ever came up.
One of the assembled toadies, Skeen, a short, wide man with heavy jowls, stood.
Well, Baron, I'd just like to say that, in my opinion, last night was a great victory for your leadership.
Victory? How so?
Well, Baron, if there were any stickies out there threatening us, you scared them off. They didn't dare attack Willyville. They knew they'd get ripped to pieces. The way you handled the situation demonstrated once again the depth of your wisdom and insight. I want you to know how grateful I am.
Elijah stared at Skeen over the rim of the dipper.
And how grateful is that, Skeen?
Well, I'm sorry, Baron. I don't understand.
Grateful enough to double your tithe to me? Come on, Skeen. You know you owe me your worthless life. If it wasn't for my patronage, you wouldn't have a scrap of bread to your name. You and that brainless wife of yours and all your brats would starve to death without me.
You know, looking at your pinhead misses and cross-eyed offspring makes me wonder if there ain't a bit of rad taint coming out in blood there somewhere.
Oh, of course I'll pay.
Not only that, you'll get down on your knees and beg me to take your Jack.
The Baron scanned the faces of the other coattail riders, the middleman who fed off his bounty.
What about all the rest of you? Don't you have anything to say? Aren't you grateful that I saved your miserable skins with my wisdom and insight?
The toadies all bowed, shooting hateful glances at Skeen. Elijah got to his feet and swept out of the ops room, heading to the elevator with Murchison in tow.
An excellent morning so far.
Yes, sir. Very profitable.
A phalanx of armed sectmen fell into step behind them as they headed for the elevator.
Baron, the boys all been pestering me, wanting to know what you've got in mind for the yellow-belly carter.
I haven't decided yet. I need to spend some time with the Apocalypticon. Got to review my options.
The Baron, Murchison, and a dozen sectmen bunched into the elevator car.
Lobby! Lobby!
Murch, I want you to send some patrols outside the wall. Look for any sign that Sticky's passed through during the night. Start the patrols in close and have them gradually fan out, but keep them inside of the berm at all times.
Better to be safe than sorry, sir.
If they find anything, I want to know about it at once.
Then Elijah noticed one of the sectmen standing off to the side. The guard was staring at his own boot tops, trying to become invisible.
Brad, blast it! Lester! What the hell are you doing here? You're supposed to be serving time on the wheel today.
I'm on my way to report for punishment now, sir.
Elijah stared at the two men standing beside Lester. They, too, were trying their best to vanish, and they had reason. The Baron recognized them as Gil and Highlander, Lester's bunker mates, the other dipshits responsible for allowing a prisoner to bring weapons into his royal presence.
Murch, I want you to send these two south. Have them run down and check on the damage to my way stop, if any.
Gil and Highlander looked at each other, then at Lester, who wouldn't meet their gaze. None of them said a word. Because of Lester's screw-up, it was death sentences all around if there were stickies about. The crew split up when they reached the lobby. Gil and Highlander got out first, stepping to one side to let Elijah and a half-dozen sectmen pass by. Murchison and three other sectmen remained in the elevator with Lester. As the Baron exited the lobby and stepped outside, his sect team stepped forward, creating a living shield on all sides of him. They escorted him in formation to the bank entrance, where they stayed outside, guarding the entrance. Once inside the one-story building's foyer, the Baron lit a torch. He walked past the teller's counter and proceeded through the barred stainless steel gate to the vault door. Only he had the combination to the lock. At least he'd had the sense to keep that from Zit. Inside the vault, the Muti librarian's handiwork was evident. Zit had gone through the diverse and voluminous material and organized it under various appropriate subject headings. He'd had no file cabinets to work with, so he just stacked the stuff in neat mounds along the walls. Elijah went straight for the section marked Chilling. Even though he couldn't read very well, many of the books and magazines had pictures, and the Baron satisfied himself with reviewing those. He set the torch in a stanchion and took his time sorting through stacks of papers, rejecting the quick and easy deaths out of hand. What he was looking for was something slow and spectacular, something that his subjects would tell their grandchildren about. He scanned through the piles of documents until he found a photograph that intrigued him. It combined great height with dizzying speed and helplessness.
Well, this looks like a real crowd pleaser.
Christy had never spent a night in a 19th century lunatic asylum, so she had no yardstick to measure the first few hours of her zoo experience. As it was, all she could do was shut her eyes tight and try to stop up her ears with her fingers. Her cage was long and narrow, and divided from those on either side by floor-to-ceiling iron bars. At the corridor end of her enclosure were more bars with a small entry gate and feeding slot. A steel-clad drop door was set in a concrete wall at the other end. The door was down. There was concrete under the matted, rotting straw of the cage. In the first moments after she'd been forced into the cell, Christy had learned that the only safe place was in the exact center of its space. If she sat right in the middle, the prisoners caged on either side of her couldn't quite reach her when they stretched their arms through gaps between the bars. After a few hours of trying to claw out her green eyes, her fellow inmates had almost given up the game. Now that it was light enough to see her nearest neighbors, Christy decided she liked the look of the scabby the least. As the mutant's name suggested, its skin was covered with ulcers and lesions. These in varying shades of yellow, black, brown, purple, and pus green. This particular example of the scabby subspecies still had a few irregularly shaped patches of pink, normal-looking skin, which were bordered by thin bands of fiery red flesh. But for the random patterning of its clots, the scabby was naked. It was about 8 months pregnant. Its bloated belly's crust was seamed with deep fissures and weeping cracks. There was no face to speak of, just two eyes peering out of a mound of scabs. Its hair, which was pale orange in color and quite long, sprouted out of a scalp crust in widely spaced tufts. Inside the mouth, the skin looked soft and normal, as did what Christy could see of the tongue. The scabby helped to support its vast stomach by cupping it with its hands.
What are you looking at, bitch?
Maybe he's counting your sores.
Christy turned to face the second speaker, her other neighbor, a scaly. Its red mutation was a bit more subtle than the scabby's. The striations of its fine scales were visible only when the light hit it in a certain way. To the casual observer, it could look like a severe case of dry skin. There was a vague reptilian cast to the slant of its eyes and the turned-up corners of its lipless mouth. The scaly was also pregnant. It wore a short skirt of pieced rags that looked like a ratty pom-pom, but nothing on top. The scaly's breasts were pendulous and doughy, and the large nipples were an angry, infected maroon.
When's your baby due?
Not a few weeks.
Question is, what's it gonna look like? Elijah bred her with about 20 males, one after another. She didn't mind, though, did ya?
The Baron did that to you? He set that many men on you?
Yeah. Baron keeps track of who he's mated with who, and who he's gonna mate with who next. Only his idea is to switch around the fathers and mothers to get the most unusual-looking specimen for his zoo.
Why so many fathers?
Elijah doesn't like to waste any of his female breeding cycles, so we always make sure we get well-seeded.
It'll happen to you, too. Soon enough, none of us ever escapes.
Christy refused to give in to the urge to throw herself at the bars of her cell and scream her outrage. She knew she had to stay calm if she was going to have a prayer of getting free of the zoo. Calm and clear-headed, as she'd need to be to help Ryan and the others. Christy was puzzled and worried by the Sticky Army's failure to show up during the night. Without a battle or the threat of an assault, they were dead.
I saw someone on the road yesterday. Maybe you know him? Big, bald, muty male, white and brown skin, three eyes.
The scaly slumped onto its butt on the floor of the cage and started drumming its heels in the straw.
Get up! Get up! Don't say a word! You don't know who she is!
Do you think she's a spy for Elijah? Since when does he give a damn about what his animals are thinking?
Red hair looks like she could pass for Norm. Maybe she's not a mutie at all.
Christy made her prehensile hair stand up in full-length spikes, then coil back against her head in tight curls.
Oh, yeah, she's one of us.
Maybe so. Still, could be working for the Baron.
This piebald man, he had an army with him. Biggest I ever saw. An army of stickies. They were coming this way.
It's him! He's come back! I told you something strange was in the air! He'd come back to us, just like he promised. Let's tell the others!
You wait! You wait! We gotta make sure of him before we pass it on. Red hair, what else did you see?
The Stickies on the highway called their leader Ka. I heard a rumor that he used to be a pet here in the Baron Zoo.
And don't know him by that name, but I might know who you're talking about. I never saw him myself. And neither is she, no matter what she lets on. We heard about him from the others who've been here longer than us. The way the story goes, the Baron used to have a patchy-colored mutie he called Three Eyes and Zip.
He called him that on account of that he had an extra eye in the middle of his forehead. Zit's eye opened up for the first time right here in the zoo. I heard a canny spouting off about it once. Said he was in the next cage, and the eye was as clear as glass, and it cried blood. When Zit looked through it, just trying it out, he killed 4 stickies on the other side of the zoo. They started shaking, their eyes bugged out, and then they shit themselves and died.
From what I hear, nobody said nothing to Knackerman about what that eye could do.
Everybody hates Knackerman, Zoo Master. And I guess nobody much cared for those stickies either. Story goes that Zit had himself an inside track with the Baron. He'd act real mean to muties whenever there were norms around. But when he was alone, with his own kind, he'd be different. He knew lots of things because he could read. He'd tell them all about the rebellion, and the Mutie War, and the slave heroes. He even made them remember the heroes' names. We all still say the names. Coop, Marrowbone, Peltier, Bowine.
Zit did some bad things for the Baron, killing Moody's and all. Some say he had to do it to stay on the Baron's good side. Others say he was a murdering, blowhard liar, that he was just using everybody to get a better deal for himself. They said he'd never come back if he left.
You figure he's going to sack Willyville with that army? Or is he headed somewhere else?
Oh, he's coming here all right. And he's going to do more than sack the place. He's going to set all these people free. No more torture. No more starving. No more getting worked to death. Our babies are going to be born free.
He's going to get blasters to those that can handle them. Then, we're going to take Deathlands from the north. Nobody in this damn zoo and nobody in the fields has a drip of sympathy for them. If Zith or Carl, or whatever he calls himself now, gives us the chance, we'll show them norms what the other end of the whip feels like. You hear that, everyone? Zith's coming back, and we're gonna get the fuck out of here!
A sudden surge of noise roused Jack from a deep sleep. Eyes still shut, he drowsily stretched his arms. Something wet, hot, and scratchy slapped the side of his face. Meat breath gusted over him. Jack looked into the face of his cellmate. The muty mountain lion's eyes were slitted with pleasure as it washed his cheek with its bristling tongue. The teenager tried to hold the beast at arm's length.
Stop!
First it claims you, then it eats you.
The swampy in the next cell leaned forward eagerly. The muty lion whirled away from Jack, throwing itself at the bars. The startled swampy jumped back so hard that it crashed into the opposite wall. The swampy was a little gnome-like creature, dressed in a ragged scrap of an overcoat and gumboots. It had the typical feral teeth and wide nose of its subspecies. Swampies weren't big, but they were a sneaky bunch and mean. Jack steeled himself for another attack from the lion. When the beast looked back at him, it got that happy expression on its face again. Its tongue lolled out, and its eyes narrowed to slits. Jack noticed that it had some wicked fangs on it, long and sharp, and claws to match. It padded up to him and rested its chin on his shoulder.
Must be thinking about some other lion. This one's a pussycat.
Hey, you're a triple stoop. That thing ain't no lion, ain't no kitty cat neither. Baron's been working on that one's line for 8, maybe 10 years. It can talk almost as good as you or me when it wants to. And as for chewing you up, it just ain't hungry right now.
Maybe, but I think he'd rather eat you. Stick your little head through the bars and find out.
Don't care to do that.
Jack had no idea why the cat's attitude about him had changed. He gazed into the huge yellow eyes and ruffled its ears. The rad-blasted thing licked his face and huffed rotten meat breath at him. Jack and the lion moved to the side of their cell that faced the uproar.
He's here! He's here! He's here!
The Swampy spun away from the bars opposite. He kicked up a wild jig in the straw.
Who's here? What's happening?
The big cat turned nose to nose with him. The blast of sound and hot air knocked Jack flat on his rear.
What the hell's going on here?
The Baron Zoomaster came running down the corridor to see what was happening. The Ackerman didn't stay for long. The muties pelted him with their droppings. He covered his head with his arms and dashed back the way he had come.